put on there. It's not the the multi, it's a multi-turn pot, but the knob doesn't point, the pointer isn't right. But I can fix that. And I was actually picking up shortwave stations and everything, and it's kind of tricky with Super Regen, but once I got the hang of it, it's a pretty cute little receiver.
What does it use as an antenna, Bill?
I hooked up my 2-meter ground plane with a clip lead to the center, and that was it. That's all I used, my 2-meter 5/8 I got here in the kitchen. Nothing special.
So you were doing that receiving at home. You didn't do it actually at the flea market itself. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. I was too wrapped up with things to play with it.
Very fine, Bill. Wes, do you have a question on some of these things that we just discussed? N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yes, I spoke to Hal on the Hampton. He showed me two capacitors, very little capacitors. One looked alike the other. The only thing is that one was huge, about 1,500 picofarad. And he said, he asked me the question, which one is frequency dependent and which one is capacitance dependent? I found it interesting. I don't know, Hal, are you still with us?
I'm still with you. Hal? Hal said he had to leave. Go ahead, Wes.
Okay, he was quick in explaining, honestly. I didn't catch much. I have two of these capacitors, and he pointed to the bigger one, and I look at the shape of the rotor and the shape of the starter. There is a certain shape to it. So I said, is it capacitance dependent? He said, no, this one is frequency dependent. Okay? Then he pointed to the second one. He said, no, this one is capacitance dependent. Enter here.
And the more rare one, the one that's frequency dependent, that's the one that's got that crazy shape to it, where if you open it up to minimum capacitance and you start rotating it in the direction of where the capacitance starts increasing, starting to mesh the plate, it starts off at a very small center section that meshes. It starts meshing very slowly at first, and then as you proceed toward full meshing of the variable rotor, the plates get larger and larger, and therefore the rate of increase in capacitance goes up by square law. Once you shape those rotors and stator plates the correct way, so that each degree of rotation of the shaft gives you an amount of capacitance that increases by a square law function instead of a linear function, then you're doing the opposite of the equation for frequency. 1 over 2 pi square root of L and C. That's what determines the frequency of a inductor capacitor circuit. So since capacitance is a function of the square root of frequency, and if you make the frequency increase by the square, when you take the square root of something that is being squared, it comes out linear. So with the right shape of that capacitor, the variable capacitor, the dial will have the same number of megacycles or kilohertz of increase for each degree of rotation if the capacitor has the right shape to it, if it increases by a square law versus rotation. That makes some sense though, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, it does. I think I knew it before. The only what I didn't notice, I'm looking the be honest with you, I was playing with it since I was a young kid, and I know that the shape is made just to keep the parameters linear. Enter again.
Yeah, if the capacitor you've got, and by the way, there are capacitors that are modified in that direction, but not all the way. But if it's truly a frequency-dependent type capacitor intended for variable frequency oscillator service, then if you had a capacitance measuring meter, which I think you do, and if you can hook up short enough leads to it so there's not much stray capacitance in your instrumentation hookup. If you then put a great big dial on the front panel of the on the shaft, and then make yourself a graph of how many picofarad you measure on your capacitance meter versus each degree of rotation of the dial, and then you make a graph of that, if it really is a frequency-dependent capacitor, you will see that the horizontal axis is degrees, the vertical axis is picofarad, and it will follow not a straight line, 45-degree line on the graph. It'll be an exponential graph. It'll be a square law graph. It'll start off with a very low slope in the beginning, and as you move to the right-hand side of the graph, the slope will increase more and more rapidly. That's the so-called square law. You'll be plotting something that looks like y equals x squared. If you plotted the curve of y equals x squared, where x goes from 0 to 10, and then you compare that to the curve you get out of your capacitor, where degrees horizontal is the horizontal axis of the graph, and picofarad is the vertical, with proper adjustment of the constants, in theory, one graph will lay on top of the other. That's what I mean by square law. Y equals x squared. And you could put a constant in front of it. Y equals k times x squared. And then you would eventually, by selecting the right k value, you would make those two graphs of picofarad.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You'd make the two graphs of picofarads of the capacitor, or y equals x squared, kx squared, when you choose the right k, those two graphs will lay on top of each other. And then when that happens, each degree of rotation will be the same number of kilohertz of change of the variable frequency oscillator that's being set by that capacitor. Any other comments on that one, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
No, looking at the geometry of that, I don't see much difference, so, you know, but yes, I can do that. So, as far as me being able to measure the parameters of the capacitor, I have everything that I could have dreamed about 2 years ago. Now, there was an item, let me jump.
I will be picking up with Alex in a minute. Go ahead, Wes.
There was an item. The guy wanted $500 for it. It was a beauty of American engineering. I don't even know if it was really American, maybe German. But it was an absolutely mechanical tool. It was Winston Bridge. I have never seen such one. On the right, it looks like some kind of coil, but it was much covered with the device. I saw something like part of the winding, and then I had the right-hand side, another something that looks like another coil, and the fibers. The right-hand side was rapid, and the left-hand side was precise, and plenty of fibers. Back to you.
Yeah, if you open up the appropriate chapter, somewhere around chapter number 4 of the major textbook called Reference Data for Radio Engineers. But you open up the chapter called Bridge Networks, B-R-I-D-G-E Networks. And Wheatstone is one of the very famous bridges. It's you draw a diamond-shaped figure on a piece of paper. On each one of the straight lines, you put either a variable resistor or a variable capacitor or whatever, but you put components on each one of the straight lines of a diamond-shaped diagram, and then you put a source of signal between the top point and the bottom point of the diamond, and you put a voltage or current sensing network between the left-hand point and the right-hand point of the diamond. That is the general circuit of a Wheatstone bridge. And then when each of the four components follow a particular equation and balance in a particular way, and you get a null on the voltage sensing circuit when a voltage is applied across the opposite two ends. Let me drop. So properly used, a Wheatstone bridge can be a very precision instrument that allows you to exactly determine resistance or capacitance or inductance or resonant frequency. If you study the thing that put the Hewlett-Packard company on the air, the Model 200 oscillator circuit, which they produced somewhere around 1938, I'm not sure the exact year, 1940, somewhere around there, they came out with this commercial product, which had, by the way, a capacitance, or a variable capacitor, which followed the frequency curve. It was a frequency-sensitive capacitor on a kind of a Wheatstone bridge circuit. They built an oscillator which has a Wheatstone bridge in its feedback, and it gave them a very precise sine wave in frequency and in accuracy as far as the amount of harmonic content. That Model 200 Hewlett-Packard oscillator was the first product of that company, and 60 years later, it's a multi-billion dollar corporation, but it all got started because of a Wheatstone bridge-like circuit in a audio oscillator. The thing, I think the very first product went from something like 1 hertz all the way up to 20 kilohertz. I think there was eventually a version that went from 1 hertz to 10 megacycles by way of the Wheatstone bridge. So now, the General Radio Company and other companies have made very precise instruments that use the Wheatstone bridge characteristic. There's a lot of various bridge networks, but Wheatstone is essentially one of the basic ones. And so you didn't mention what brand name that was, and I don't know if you really need it, but if you like collecting classic pieces of test equipment, I guess you saw something that you were drooling over, but I guess you and the guy selling it didn't quite come to an agreement. Back to you, Wes. Oh, wait a minute. Let's pick up Alex. Alex wanted to make a comment on something. N2NNU from Romania. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, hello, good afternoon, Dick, and good afternoon, Donette.
It's a little out of order here, what I'm going to say, so I'm not sure if you want to pick it up now or later, but you mentioned something about junks and whatnot, and you picked up that beautiful circulator that was a one-piece radar, which triggered in my mind the remembrance of a question I wanted to put for a long time, and I didn't get to it. So I'm going to put a question now. You don't have to answer it right now, whenever you have the time, or if it is probably after the net or whatever. Talking about radars, I don't see any activity of the radio amateurs and the radar in the radar field. Some problems in not allowing us to make a space radar, for example. I want to see what's out there in the space. So the question is that permissible to us? So whenever you have the time, let me get back to you.
Yeah, amateur radio is allowed pulse transmissions, and a radar is really a pulse transmitter. I'm not sure, but I think one of the first bands where we're allowed to use pulse transmission is the 1200 megacycle ham band in the United States. So a number of the so-called microwave bands, we are allowed to transmit pulse. And I'm trying to remember now, 1296 pulse transmission. The very first ham radio transmission on 1296, way back in the 1940s, was a pulse transmitter. So ham radio operators are allowed to use pulse. Therefore, they're allowed to construct a radar. Now, I do recommend that you do a back-of-the-envelope calculation in order to find out how much transmit power is required, how much antenna gain is required, how much receiver sensitivity is required, in order to measure an object in space. If you know the size of the object in space, and I'm now speaking about electronic size, an electronic size, as far as a radar is concerned, is called its RCS number, radar cross-section. So, if, for instance, I'm talking about a 707 airplane, and if I go to the right reference, I can find out that the broadside view of a 707 airplane has, I'm going to pick a number, 1,000 square meters of radar cross-section. Once I know the size of the target electronically, then I can plug the numbers into the so-called radar range equation, which is in the Skolnick book, Introduction to Radar, or his other book called Radar Design, but you go to the Skolnick book and the radar range equation, you plug in the numbers that you've got versus the thing you want to use as a target, and you find out, are you going to be above threshold? The reason I'm mentioning this is that most things in space that you're going to want to look at as a radar are in general going to be, let me pick a number, more than 1,000 miles away from your house. And so even though you might have direct line of sight to that particular target, for you in your backyard to set up equipment that can pick up a target at 1,000 miles, it's a fairly serious challenge. But don't be turned off by that. There was a ham radio operator, by using some very fancy techniques, who bounced a signal off of Venus and got a recognizable echo. So it can be done, but it's damn difficult. Back to you on that one, though, Alex. By the way, that thing that I picked up was a precise 20 decibel waveguide directional coupler, precision directional coupler, that had built into it 50 decibels of directivity. It has put a horn antenna on the front of that directional coupler and a pulsed signal generator feeding the coupler. And off the coupler port, you put a receiver, and that becomes a one-piece radar. The transmit-receive circuitry is all wrapped into that precision directional coupler. I've had a lot of fun waving that horn around the room and looking at the echoes of various objects in my room. It was a very simple radar. N2, NNU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you for picking up the question immediately. Yes, I understand that, the problems we have in detecting that small pieces out in space. However, now and then there appears opportunities, and I can buy a whole system for a song, just install it and have it. It's a matter only of legislation. If we are allowed to beam so much power through space, into space, if there is any legislation that we have to talk with FAAs or in my case with the Romanian authorities for aviation, so they will know that they might be crossing my beam and stuff like this. I'm not sure if this might be an impediment or not. What do you think?
I, for instance, have built a radar system and operated it on a ham radio band. And I did that while using my business. I was working as an electronic engineer for Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I wanted to borrow a particular radar from them in order to, a man-pack portable radar, to do a particular experiment. And you can read about this whole experiment because I posted it on the internet. If you go to the K5RMG, K5 Rodeo, Romeo Mike Golf, the K5RMG, what's it called? Roadrunners Group, Roadrunners Microwave Group. You Google the word K5RMG, K5 Roadrunners Microwave Group, and you look at their technical section, and at the bottom of that page, you'll find the K2RIW corner, and you'll read of the 10 articles there, one of them is the article about the radar cross-section. I went and measured the cross-section of something where my company was afraid I would be creating radio frequency biohazards. This is something right up your alley. You'll get a kick out of reading that article, Alex. My company was afraid to loan me the radar, even though I had permission from the safety department, but the supervisors of the company got cold feet, and I wanted to do this experiment, me and the guys on the project. Let me drop this. So I used my ham radio license, used a ham radio transmitter, converted it into a pulse transmitter as a radar, and went and made the measurement, and the project was quite successful. And so the people who had the coldest feet on that project are the ones that got fired because they wouldn't let us go through with this project that potentially could make the company a lot of money. There was a strong misunderstanding of the physics, and there was a lot of personality problems that got worked out by a backdoor approach, if you know what I mean. So ham radio operation and radar is, at least in the United States, on most of the microwave frequencies, is very legal. It's almost encouraged in the United States. Now, I, of course, don't know Romanian law, and that's going to take an investigation on your part. Let us know how that project works out. Wesley, let me drop this. I keep confusing you guys with an accent. Alex has really built radars as an occupation. When he built his ultrasound networks, which were sending ultrasonic signals into a human being in order to do imaging of what goes on inside a human being, that really is an acoustic radar. So radar is you could say a bat uses acoustic radar. Alex used acoustic radar, and the RF equivalent works very well.
What is the limitation of power?
Well, you're now asking, in the United States, is it the peak envelope power or the average power that's limited? And there I don't know. But even if the limitation is peak envelope power, a number of people who wanted to run an experiment didn't find great difficulty as long as the signal was aimed in the right direction that didn't give any other equipment interference and didn't create a biohazard. As long as you can confirm those things, it isn't too difficult in the United States to get a STA, Special Temporary Authority, from the FCC to run higher than normal power. An awful lot of the moonbound guys have gotten a STA in order to run greater than 1,000 watts while doing moonbounce, as long as the antenna is a high-gain device aimed at the moon and using frequencies that are not interfering with other equipment. Getting that permission is not very difficult.
Maybe Eric would know.
I don't think so. So, I'm going to move on now, Alex. We should be going to the mailbag. John, what kind of mail have we gotten this week? KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. It's KC2WGB. We've got a couple of good ones here. Just let me let it drop. Okay, have a gentleman here, young gentleman, who's wondering about mag mounts, and he's finding it very difficult to understand how that capacitance effect of the mag mount is equal to or better than a actual bolt to the mainframe and conducting to the metal. He's looking at the fact that if he's putting out 100 watts from the antenna, that means 100 watts basically on the negative side has to be coupled to the car frame. So maybe you could explain how that works, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
And the way a mag mount works, with a sheet of plastic in the bottom so that the magnet doesn't scratch the paint on the roof of your automobile, and the way a dipole that has been shrunk down in physical size works have a strong similarity. To set up a dipole and make it physically a half wavelength long, on 80 meters, it'd be a 132-foot long piece of wire, usually fed in the center, but it doesn't have to be. You could, if you want to, take that 132-foot length of wire, shrink it down to, let me pick a number, 45 feet, and if you use the right kind of loading coils in the center, zigzagging of the wire, top hat capacitors at the end, tapering of the wire, there are various techniques which allow you to electronically maintain the same resonant frequency, yet you physically shrunk down the end-to-end length of the antenna. So there's all kinds of ways of shrinking something electronically, and you're restoring resonance by other means. Every antenna that you and I normally use, other than a rhombic or beverage, these antennas that are a zillion wavelengths long, when it comes to a reasonable number of wavelengths of antenna, every antenna we use that's going to have any reasonable amount of efficiency, there's a universal law that should be told to every antenna engineer and every electrical engineering course, and it is not told to them. It's kept as a secret, and I don't understand why. Let me drop. The magic of every antenna of reasonable size is you resonate the antenna first. Then it has the ability to radiate with reasonable efficiency. You resonate first, then you can radiate. And you're resonating the radiating structure. The radiating structure can consist of the thing you call antenna, the thing you call antenna tuner, the feed line that goes between it and the transmitter, the antenna tuner that might be in the shack, and the final stage of the transmitter's tank circuit. that is the radiating system. You resonate that radiating system, it has the ability to radiate. So with that capacitive coupling that's on the bottom of the mag mount, that's just a loading capacitor that's built into the antenna system. As long as that capacitor plus the rest of the antenna resonates, it has the ability to radiate, and whether or not you feed the antenna in the center, it doesn't matter. That 132-foot dipole, even before I do anything to mechanically shrink it, I don't have to feed it in the center. I can feed it 10% off to one side, 50% off to one side, or I can feed it at the outer edge. I'm feeding a different impedance, but as long as I'm smart enough to set up the right kind of a balancing structure, I am pumping energy into that resonant structure. The energy bounces back and forth in that resonant structure. 5% of it gets radiated on each bounce, and you wait for 20 bounces, so to speak, and essentially all of your signal gets radiated into space. That's what an antenna does. So does it have to be exactly grounded? If you've got the right kind of a balancing structure, let me drop it. The answer is no. Now, in the case of a 2-meter ground plane antenna on the top of an automobile, if the area between the magnet and the top of the automobile has enough square inches to it so that through that thin sheet of capacitance, the total amount of capacitance is, let me pick a number, 100 picofarads, and it might be as high as that if you've got a big enough magnet, and if the capacitive reactance of 100 picofarads, I don't know exactly what the number is, but maybe it's 5 ohms, if I'm getting 5 ohms of capacitive reactance, and the actual base of the antenna is a much higher impedance than that, and as long as you've got the right kind of a balancing impedance matching structure built into the base of that magma, the thing can have 98% efficiency. Good common sense would lead you to believe the antenna is going to work correctly if the base of the antenna is screwed down to the sheet metal and making direct contact. But radio-wise, you don't need direct contact. You just need electronic contact. So, an example I often use about Arnold Schwarzenegger pushing on a weight, well, you're still using the automobile roof as the counterpoise. You just got this impedance matching device called capacitance in between you and that counterpoise. And as long as you've got the antenna properly set up for resonance, properly set up for impedance match, properly set up for balancing function, that can be a 99% efficient system. So don't be afraid of the capacitance loading at the base, as long as that capacitance is repeatable to you. And if it's large enough, it doesn't even have to be repeatable. If it's a large enough capacitor with a small enough capacitor reactance, if it's got 5 ohms of capacitor reactance and the capacitance and the plastic gets squeezed a little bit and it goes down to 4 ohms of capacitor reactance, that's almost no change. The thing will continue to work. So mag mounts work very well, even though some people lose the faith in them. KC2 WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good description. Yes, I can understand the mystery why it seems like it shouldn't work with an insulator between it, but it really isn't. That capacitor is conducting just like it was designed to do. Difficult to understand for the young people, I assume. But yes, they do work. Let me get to the next one. Let me let it drop. Okay, here's a clever new one. This gentleman has constructed a thing we've talked about many times, the slot antenna. He has done it on a piece of plexiglass, approximately 6 inches wide and about 24 inches long. He laid 2 strips of copper adhesive tape with a separation of approximately 1/4 inch. They're about 1 inch wide. They run the length for a 2-meter antenna. And he has the wire soldered on the bottom, a little coax wire there. And he has a sliding bridge between the two elements that goes up and down in a slot in the plastic. And that's how he tunes it. But not only that, Dick, he has this on like a railroad semaphore flag with a solenoid that pulses. And he can tilt it 45 degrees from vertical or 90 degrees. So what do you think about that antenna? And he says it works very well. The only thing he's going to try next is he might put it on a rotor to see when it's in the horizontal position. If he uses it with a rotor, in the vertical position, because it's horizontally polarized, he's going to see how it works. So what do you think of that?
Hey, John, he's my kind of people. The very first antenna patent that I had filed was built in a manner very similar to that. I started off with a thin sheet of plastic. It may have been plexiglass, it may have been polycarbonate, it may have been mylar, I'm not sure, but it was a sheet of plastic. I had a great big roll of copper adhesive tape, and by cutting up the pieces of copper tape just right and laying it out on the plastic, I built a three-element Yagi antenna, and I was able to move things around in positions and lengths and whatever, and by peeling up the edges of the copper tape, I could tune the length of the antenna by peeling up and rolling the edges of it. He's building a trombone-like structure or a tunable skeleton slot antenna, but he's got a tunable antenna, and that can be very effective, and it's a nice way of experimenting. If he's got this is the best of all worlds. If this is the best of all worlds, he would be putting that antenna's coaxial cable into a Rodenschwarz vector network analyzer, and by displaying the Smith chart display, he would be seeing the resistive component and the reactive component in the Smith chart manner displayed on the screen as he changes that shorting bar, as he changes the tilt of the antenna, as he puts his fingers on it, as he puts another piece of copper nearby. He could have a grand old time making various kinds of antennas and watching the impedance on a swept frequency display of a Smith chart-like display on that vector network analyzer. And I keep forgetting the model number that I keep telling you that I use every day of my life, so to speak. But that's one of the nicest ways of making experimental trombones, experimental antennas, experimental stub tuners, experimental slug tuners. You can do a lot of VHF, UHF experiments in that manner. Copper tape on plastic sheeting. And then think about even using multiple layers of the sheeting. Oh, you're going to have a grand old time with this thing. That's a very nice tweaking tool he's got there, John. Give him encouragement. He's going down the right path. That's a good, curious guy, if you know what I mean. He's going to learn a lot about the physics of antennas and resonance and impedance matching. And by the slots he's building, he's really starting to build something called a frequency selective surface. You read the Ben Rich book. I think it's Ben Rich. Yes. Has a book, a McGraw-Hill book, called Frequency Selective Surfaces, and you start building these things on plastic sheet, the more you can have a grand old time, generating signals, directing the signals, allowing signals of certain frequencies to feed through the sheet, onward and upward. He could spend half a lifetime filling with all the possibilities he's got there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I think he's found a fascinating area, and it is such an adjustable item, he should be able to do a lot of experimentation with that. I will give him a return email for encouragement, because I think he can do a lot more with that. Maybe he could try stacking a few of them and playing like that. But very nice and very well constructed. And we also heard from our gentleman, Sid, with the two Yagis that were on the stepper motors, by the way. Let me drop. KC2WGB. Well, he's not giving up on this item yet. I'm sure you remember this discussion from last week. He's restructured it. He's got a separation now between them of 10 feet. And he has changed it from moving the boom laterally to rotating the boom on the upper antenna. What he's doing is tilting it like your Yagi, 45 degrees in one direction back to its horizontal position and 45 degrees to the other direction. And he's thinking of doing it to the second one also for attenuation. What do you think of the setup? And he's already into this. He's already got the motor set up and all. What do you think the outcome is going to be? He hasn't tested it yet.
Yeah, I think his output is somewhat predictable, reasonably predictable. If he had the right kind of an electronic switch that he could decide to feed the lower Yagi or the upper Yagi, that's one kind of testing. If he's got a power divider and he's feeding both simultaneously, that's another kind of testing. As he rotates the upper Yagi all the way to being vertically polarized when it started off horizontally polarized, and with the right forward and aft, or the right phase angle of the feeding between them, between the two Yagis, he will be generating circular polarization. Now, in the case of them being orthogonal in polarization, vertical for the upper Yagi, horizontal for the lower Yagi, in that particular case, he did not need the 10-foot of spacing. They could have been both mounted on the exact same boom, all of those elements. And that would be another method of making circular. So, he will be generating circular polarization when they're orthogonal. When the upper Yagi is 45 degrees left or right, he's now making a kind of elliptical polarization on the horizon. And it will be interesting to see, under certain propagations of certain days, let me drop. Mother Nature is always changing polarizations of the signals that you see. The only thing left to discuss is how much. That buddy of yours in London who's sending you from his vertical ground plane antenna a purely vertically polarized signal, when that signal mixes with the ionosphere, and the ionosphere is a ionized plasma with the Earth's magnetic field mixed into it, therefore it will experience Faraday polarization rotation. Mr. Faraday is the guy who first found out a lot about this. So therefore that vertically polarized signal issued by the transmitter in London is being twisted some number of times as it goes through the ionosphere. By the time it comes to your QTH in New York City, it could very well be a horizontally polarized signal, a slant 45 polarized, a slant 45 to the left polarized signal. So the polarization will be different. By way of his rotation of that upper Yagi, he is getting a kind of polarization probing of the environment. If he was able to rotate the polarization of the lower Yagi and the upper Yagi simultaneously, now he could truly go from all possible linear polarizations, and by various combinations of them being orthogonally polarized to each other, in other words, at right angles, and feeding various phase angles to them, he can now be transmitting clockwise circular, counterclockwise circular, elliptical, to the right, to the left, and so on. So he's starting to build a polarimeter. He's a couple of steps downrange of what the radio astronomy people call polarimetry measurement. Let me drop. A large number of those stars and nebula out there that the radio telescopes look at have local magnetic fields that create certain polarization characteristics. That's one of the signatures of, let's say, a galaxy or a star or a nebula. You might be looking at a particular nebula with your radio telescope and knowing what the polarimetry characteristics of the center, the left-hand side, and the right-hand side of that nebula is. Measuring polarization characteristics tells you by way of the so-called Zeeman effect what is the local magnetic field doing. So he's moving in that direction of building a polarimeter. And so that signal he listens to on 6 meters or 2 meters, there are times when he'll find out that certain settings of that antenna will peak the signal. Unfortunately, he'll find out that unless he has a very rapid polarization rotating motor, because the QSB of the signal he's listening to is slowly going up and down, as his polarimetry is being slowly rotated by a motor, there could be some ambiguity between the two. It sure would be nice if the polarization could be rotated rapidly. With the right kind of mechanical mechanism, that's not too difficult to do, because the angular moment of inertia of a Yagi that's being rotated about the axis of the boom, it's got very little moment of inertia, and therefore rotating it in that manner can be done quite rapidly with very little power. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
I'm sure you could do that, especially if he's switching between like 0 and 90 or 0 and 45. He could use the stepper motors with mechanical actuators to do that. Other than that, he would probably have to gear up the stepper motors. But that is a good point. One question I have about it, Dick, if he were to motorize both antennas and if the yaw remained the same and he just changed the roll 45 to the left on the top, 45 to the right on the bottom, would that be the same as one antenna, effectively, assuming point source signal?
John, good question, John. And the answer is yes and no simultaneously. When the upper antenna is rotated 45 degrees to the left, the lower antenna is rotated 45 degrees to the right, and assuming both antennas have the same Z-axis location in forward and aft, so that they're co-located in the direction of propagation, and they're being fed in a co-phase manner. They're being fed with a Wilkinson hybrid site as the power divider, so they're being fed equal phase signals. In that condition, 45 left on the top, 45 right on the bottom, even though they're displaced by 10 feet, at the bore site, at the mechanical bore site, a signal in that direction will see pure circular polarization. That's the good news. But now, for a guy that's a little bit in azimuth, more clockwise or counterclockwise in azimuth, so if the antenna's aimed to the north, and he starts talking to a guy a little bit further to the east or a little bit further to the west without mechanically rotating the whole array, because of that mechanical separation, wait a minute now, they're vertically displaced, not a problem. For signals of a different elevation, as if he was doing a helicopter test out in front of the antenna, and as he changed the elevation of the helicopter, started off the helicopter on the ground, moved it up to 500 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet above the ground, he's now doing a kind of interferometry test where the upper antenna, the signal will arrive earlier than the lower antenna, therefore the pure circular polarization will start becoming elliptical. But where he's got vertical displacement, that's not a problem. Yeah. Well, as he gets very far from mechanical bore site, when he rotates the antenna array in azimuth, when talking to somebody on the horizon, because the horizontal beamwidth and the vertical beamwidth of the antenna are not...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because the horizontal beamwidth and the vertical beamwidth of the two Yagis are not exactly the same, you'll get a little bit of disturbance of that circular polarization. But no, that will be a purely circular polarized signal on the horizon. And so he's starting to get into the area of polarimetry. A polarimetry sensing antenna is one where you've got two orthogonal components of polarization to play with. You might have a horizontal probe and a vertical probe in a piece of waveguide, for instance. And if you can adjust the individual amplitudes and phases of the signal that arrives at those two probes, then you have complete polarization agility. You can make every single kind of polarization that exists on that so-called Poincaré sphere. If you go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook and you go to the section on circular polarization, this guy, this mathematician expert named Poincaré, a French name, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, he has made a representation that looks like a globe of the Earth, but depending on whether you're talking about the North Pole, the South Pole, the equator, or anything in between, every one of those locations on the globe mathematically represents a certain polarization sense of an elliptical polarized wave. Just like every orbit of a planet around the sun is never perfectly circular, there's always some amount of ellipticity. By the same token, every signal that you and I radiate, you think your Yagi is horizontal, and you think you're transmitting pure horizontal polarization. You do a careful enough laboratory measurement, you'll find out there's a little bit of vertical polarization coming out of your antenna because of the feed mechanism you used on the driven element. As such, there's a slight degree of elliptical polarization on almost every antenna we've ever used. I know this is some of this material is way off to one side, but there's a lot to be studied in polarization. It's one of the areas of antenna engineering.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's one of the areas of antenna engineering that is highly misunderstood, even by a number of the antenna engineers with quite a few years of experience. If it was properly explained to them by the right kind of a professor, it's not that difficult. But the way fields and waves are presented to the average student in most of the schools that I know about, it ends up as something very difficult to understand, and I know that whole procedure of that education could be drastically improved. polarization and standing wave ratio are two of the areas where a lot of improvement in the educational process is required. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, that's the reason I asked that question myself, because I anticipated his next question, which I thought might be that, because that may be what he tries next. But you're right. A better explanation by these professors might be required, and that may be it. Well, that's about it, those three questions. That's about it from Mel's Corner. Oh, by the way, Dick, did you get my pictures I sent you, Dick?
I went and looked, and I have not received an email from you today. Well, that was as of some time ago. Let me double-check right now and see if I did get something from you. Maybe it just arrived late. I know what your email address looks like, and for reason I don't understand, okay, I'm in the wrong place. Now I'm in the right place. No, I have not received an email from you today. I wonder if it got sent to the right email address, John. Back to you, John.
Yeah, I sent it to the same address I always send it to. I'll double-check that. I know Bernie got it. I sent it to Bernie, but I'll double-check that. I'll send it again. But, it was a microwave coffee can antenna, pictures of one that I had constructed. Okay, that's about it from Mel's Corner, and you pick it up to KC2WGB.
Did I hear earlier that you have decided to help a buddy building a magnetic rail gun, and that you've been shooting projectiles into pieces of cloth and penetrating them in Staten Island? Is that somewhat has been going on, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. Aluminum projectiles, approximately a quarter inch in diameter, about an inch and a quarter long, and some of them were drilled out to make them hollow, and we're shooting them into red brick, the red brick, the matte bricks, and penetrating.
Wow. Got a guess as to what kind of velocity? And the red matte brick, is that the kind of brick I would build a house with? What kind of penetration are you getting there, John? That sounds like a real weapon.
The red matte brick is the brick with no holes in it, and it's sort of has a rough texture like a cinder block. It's a common brick, but it's not the vitreous brick. It's one that if you hit it with a hammer, you could break it. And we have broken pieces off of the brick. A couple of shots actually cracked the brick right in half. Single shots.
The brick you're talking about has roughly what thickness, John?
About 3.5 inches.
So you're breaking pieces off of a brick that's 3.5 inches that's got a matte finish. Got a rough guess as to what kind of projectile velocities you're getting?
Not yet, Dick. We didn't make any measurements. I'm also going to do some photography with it. I don't know the speed. I know it's quick. We tried to shoot them up in the air, but we couldn't follow them. They just traveled too fast. So then we decided to stay within like 10 meters and see what kind of damage we could do. I tried a few of the granite stones, but they were bouncing off of that like, forget about it. So we didn't do that. And I tried some cork substances and things like that. I sort of try to compare it to a .22, like shooting a .22 caliber into a phone book and seeing what the penetration is. The projectile has a little too much diameter to make that comparison, so that's why we went to chipping the bricks to see what effect that would have. But I'll have some data on that soon, I'm sure.
And you're shooting at bricks 10 meters away, 32 feet away, 31 feet away. Wow. And chipping them away. Is this a mechanical engineering college project that you're helping somebody on? John, go ahead.
No, Dick, strictly for amusement and, you know, to keep busy and to learn at the same time. We started off by making a solenoid type, which wasn't successful. It worked, but not good. Then we went to pancake coils on a solenoid type. The problem is charging the capacitors. There's so many capacitors. It takes so long between shots. So that got the B-plus supply to charge the capacitors. We've got to do something a little more efficient.
actual rail accelerator with these pancakes, coils, and the capacitors, how long is your accelerator assembly from front to back, John? Go ahead.
The rail gun and the coil type are totally different. Rail gun does not use any coils at all. It uses two aluminum bars approximately a meter long and separated by only 3/8 of an inch. And there's a plastic guide bolted in there that the projectile lays on. And the discharge capacitors go into the aluminum rails, and that creates a magnetic field. And it's a dead short. And we have 50, 60 of these very large boot capacitors that we charge up to about 500 volts. And then it's discharged into that rail. Now what happens is the aluminum pellet is laying on a plastic groove between those two pieces, and the magnetic field, the Lorentz effect, causes it to move forward.
Is that the one that you're using now that is most successful?
Yes.
And the length of that rail is roughly what, John?
The device is about a meter long, but the actual rails may be, trying to think exactly, maybe the rail itself is maybe like 35 inches, 34 inches, somewhere around there.
A little less than a meter. The plastic carriage that rides between the two rails, that's what holds the projectile in the right place during the acceleration. Does that, when it gets to the end, does that get caught, or does that proceed, and does that get lost? What happens to that little plastic carriage?
No, it doesn't work that way. It's like a plastic yardstick or a meter stick, and it is sandwiched in between the rails. The projectile lays on that plastic, which has a little bit of a groove in it, like if you were to take a round file and drag it on it, just to keep it centered, and it slides on that piece of nylon.
Yeah, when you finally find out the right address, I'd like to see a picture of that. That sounds like a fun project. What a piece of science. And I think in theory, you can calculate the total amount of stored energy in your capacitors, 1/2 CV squared. You can make an approximation as to what efficiency you're getting between discharge energy and acceleration energy. You know the approximate mass of your aluminum projectile. Therefore, I think there's ways of calculating what velocity your railgun's going to be giving you. I know that's downrange, but have you guys considered anything along those lines, John? And by the way, how long does it take to charge those capacitors? How many microfarads and how many volts they get charged to? And that must be a humongous relay that discharges them. Go ahead.
Actually, it's a whole van full of capacitors, about 60 capacitors. I think they're 8,500 mic each at a 500-volt rating. And charging them takes approximately 20 minutes until we can get an effective amount of power.
Wow. What's your rough guess as to how many amperes goes into that rail and therefore goes through that relay? And is the relay a plasma type or is it really contacts coming together?
It's brute force contact. It's a little solenoid that slams a piece of aluminum straight up to make the contact, just like a solenoid switch, and it destroys the aluminum after a few shots, too. So, we'll work on that. That'll be no problem.
Yeah, one last question. Make me a rough guess as to the total number of microfarads, and I think you're charging them, did you say 5,000 volts? Go ahead.
No, it's 500 volts. There's 60 capacitors at 8,500 mic.
Okay, I can figure that out. Is your charging circuit a pulse width modulator? Is it a switching type power supply that's doing the charging, or is it a brute force rectifier? How are you actually doing that charging, John? Go ahead.
Yep, it's a brute force rectifier, and it's charging through a charging resistor, which dissipates a tremendous amount of heat on the initial charge. As the current starts to come down, of course, that charging resistor cools off. And eventually, we can put the power supply directly across the capacitors. But we can't do that without a charging resistor on the initial charge.
I can certainly understand why using a charging resistor. You cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. So when they start off thoroughly discharged, it's a dead short circuit, and without that series resistor, you'd be burning up your power supply. By definition, when you build that kind of a capacitor charging network with a dropping resistor, the very best you can do with ideal components everywhere is 50% efficiency of all the power your power supply is generating. Exactly half of it, or a little more, is going into your resistor network and the wiring to it. The other half is going into the capacitors. You're getting 50% efficiency energy-wise right now. That's the best you can do. If you flip over to a pulse width modulated switching regulator, a buck type voltage regulator, if you do it with a switching regulator, you can make the efficiency go to 100% instead of 50%. You can take your charging time and cut it exactly in half. Would that be interesting to you, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely. That would be interesting, because right now we wait until the charge cycle gets fairly low, then we jump that resistor out completely and let the charger bring it up to full charge, and that's what takes so long. So sure, that would be a great way to do it, but that's another refinement. First, you've got to get the damn thing to work, you know?
Yeah, my guess is you wait until the voltage comes up to 80 or 90% of normal voltage. Then you short out the series resistor. Therefore, you think you don't have a series resistor. You still do. You got the exact same amount of efficiency when the resistor is shorted out. If the power supply is capable of putting out, let me pick a number, 500 volts, and you're sitting at 420 volts right now, that 80 volts of drop, even though you shorted out the resistor, it is still taking place. That 80 volts of drop is a resistive drop in the secondary winding of the transformer, the primary winding of the transformer, the series resistance of the diodes, and the rest of the wiring. You still have a dropping resistor. All you've done is to change the magnitude in ohms of the dropping resistor, which, believe it or not, does. It changes your charging rate, changes the current that you're putting in, but it doesn't change the efficiency. Once you flip over to a switching type power supply, where what you're going to be doing, let me drop, the buck type switching regulator will be charging an inductor on the first half cycle, discharging the inductor into the capacitor on the second half cycle, and then you repeat the process. That technique of inductor charging, capacitor charging, by that sequence, can approach 100% efficiency, whereas the resistor divider, the resistor dropping technique, can never exceed 50% efficiency. So you'll get twice the amount of energy per period of time, a hell of a lot less heat in the room, and roughly half the charging time when you flip over to the other network. I didn't say it's going to be easy. And we can. What's your guess as to the total number of amperes maximum you're putting into those capacitors, John? Go ahead.
Dick, at a guess, I would say probably 10 amperes, somewhere around there. I'm not sure. I didn't make those measurements. But I'm also worried about buckling the plates in the capacitors by charging them too much. So maybe we would be better off with the pulse width style of charging. But, we'll have to get to that down the line. And this is not being done indoors, Dick. This is much too dangerous.
Yeah, very smart move. You've got a whole lot of capacitors there in some kind of a series parallel network. And if one of them decides to become a dead short, and all the energy of one of them gets dumped into the shorted capacitor, you do have a kind of a bomb there. So to do that outdoors is very smart. The charging cycle of those capacitors is not the damaging part. If you're pouring 10 or 20 amperes into capacitors, no sweat. During the instant of discharge, when thousands of amperes are flowing into your rails, that's the only part that's capable of doing damage to a capacitor as far as the wiring of the internal wiring of the plates of the capacitor is concerned. The only other destructive mechanism you've got to worry about is dielectric breakdown in the capacitors. In other words, if the capacitor is rated for 450 volts and you're putting 500 volts on there, I know it's not your case, but if that's what it was, and you get an arc inside, that's a destructive mechanism. So warping the plates of the capacitor If it's going to happen at all, it's only happening on discharge. The most gentle portion of your whole operation here is the charging cycle. And I guess you're